are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and access to a high-quality artistic community at a price that is affordable. If you want to find out more about the Poetry Salon and join one of our many online workshops, take one of our e-courses, or come to one of our readings or book club discussions, find out more about us and how you can join at www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, enjoy our interview with our featured guest artist.
First sunrise. 10 hours after he died, I stood at the copy machine with the other teachers, photocopying readings for my substitute. I hadn't told anyone yet. As I held the book down against the glass to scan it, a green laser lit up the room. My hand became an alien hand, the air some exotic, otherworldly vapor. But then the math teacher snapped at me for putting the wrong color paper in tray 4, and I was still human, oxygen filling my lungs. The Spanish teachers chatted in Spanish as students jostled each other in the halls or walked with their heads down. The sun had not yet risen on that first day without him in the world, but it did. It has every day since. The next poem that I'll be reading is called Elegy for My Sister's Journal, and this also appears in Night Swim. When the policeman handed me your journal in the evidence bag, I left it there unread, claiming some small victory in refusing your final words. And when the psychic at a party claimed to have a message for me, from you, I shook my head and said, no, thank you. A year after your death, I awoke to your fist, urgent, banging against my bedroom door. I could have opened it, could have given you the chance to unburden yourself. Maybe after I listened, you would finally have left me alone. The truth is, all of this could just be my strange way of taking a stand. My sister is gone, and no ghost can take her place. Can you see me here writing this poem, brooding in our childhood bedroom, stuffed animals smiling stupidly from the dresser? I'm staring unblinking at the scorched doors the way a child does when sulking. Keep your journal and your fist. Instead, give me the bag in which you took your last breath, the film that lifted away from your cheeks, cheeks I once compared to winter apples. Give me the last thing you laid eyes on, vase of fake flowers on the nightstand, your daughter's photo on your home screen, the window sealed shut from the inside.
That is the voice of Joan Kwan Glass on the Poetry Salon Cast. Joan, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to read your bio before we dive in. Joan Kwan Glass's first full-length poetry collection, Night Swim, won the 2021 Diode Editions Book Contest. She is the author of the chapbooks How to Make Pancakes for a Dead Boy from Harbor Editions 2022, and If Rust Can Grow on the Moon, Milk and Cake Press 2022. In 2021, she was a runner-up for the Sundress Publications Chapbook Contest, a finalist for the Harbor Review Editor's Prize, the Subnivian Award, and the Lumiere Review Writing Contest. Joan is a graduate of Smith College and serves as Poet Laureate for the city of Milford, Connecticut, and as poetry co-editor for West Trestle Review. She has spent the past 20 years as an educator in the Connecticut public schools. Her poems have recently been published or are forthcoming in Diode, The Rupture, Nell, Rattle, Pyrene's Fountain, Swim, Dialogist, South Florida Poetry Journal, Honey Literary, Mom Egg, Rust and Moth, Lantern Review, and many others. Joan has been nominated multiple times for the Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net. She tweets at Joan Glass. Read her previously published work at www.joanquanglass.com. Joan Quan Glass, welcome to the Poetry Saloncast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I also like to say a little bit about how I know the poets that I invite onto the Poetry Saloncast. And we've been friends on Facebook for a long time, but I think this is the first time we're actually talking with each other face to face. And I think I became familiar with your work partially because I saw the poems that you were posting on Facebook, but also I think because I've been good friends in person and on Facebook with Sonia Greenfield, and you were reading out one of her book events as well. And I remember hearing, I think, one of the poems you read today and going, I just really need to talk to this person. I really want to check out her work. And unfortunately, you had 3 books published in a year, so I was able to to get my wish and read more of your work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this past year was really being at home during that first COVID year. I had, you know, the quiet and the space and the time to write. And I'm missing that. I wrote How to Make Pancakes for a Dead Boy first. I submitted that. I sent it out, you know, to a few different places. And then after I sent that out, I worked on Night Swim. And then I sent that out. And I think while I had sent out Night Swim, How to Make Pancakes for a Dead Boy got picked up for publication. And I believe before Night Swim was accepted for publication, I had started writing, or was like halfway through writing, If Rust Can Grow on the Moon. How to Make Pancakes for a Dead Boy is focused entirely on the loss of my nephew to suicide. And Night Swim, you know, as you know, is focused on the experience of losing both of them, as well as the period afterwards, and just the grieving process. It's divided into the stages of grief. And just putting the poems into those categories was a very interesting and strange process, because for some of them it was difficult for me to decide.
Yeah. And can you remind us, what are those stages of grief?
Oh, well, let me refer to my book so that I make sure I get them correct. I know there are others also, you know, like depending on who you ask or who you talk to. But the way that I, you know, the ones that I chose are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
Yeah, that's, I believe that's Kubler-Ross. And, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar, interesting fact, but I think she's one of the few female figures who we look to in therapy. I mean, everyone knows Freud, everyone knows Jung, but I believe it's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is the one who kind of, you know, came up with or discovered, solidified, wrote about the stages of grief. And the cycles of grief aren't linear. And once you pass through one, it doesn't mean it's over. It can still come back again.
Right.
But I think your book really very, I was really paying attention to the ordering of the poems and thinking about the order that they were in and how they kind of walk the reader through a very, I would say, kind of a, you know, multifaceted experience of losing your nephew and then your sister shortly thereafter. And And they're not all completely linear. Sometimes it's flashbacks and it's memories. And so that's really interesting to hear that you were separating them by the five stages of grief.
Yeah. And that's not how the book, I didn't originally have the book set up that way. But the editor that I was working with, that was really their idea. And it completely changed the way that I thought about the book. And it gave me a format through which to understand the poems differently. And so, you know, I'm forever grateful for that idea, because I don't know that I would have come up with that. I probably would not have.
Yeah. It's very difficult to sometimes separate the poems from, you know, the style and everything from the content of the poem. So for those who haven't read Night Swim, obviously, I'm definitely recommending you get it. It's about the experience of your nephew dying by suicide, and then shortly after your sister does. I felt the first handful of poems, you know, they had to do a lot of heavy lifting, letting the reader know what are the facts. What are the facts that we need to know in order to access the book? And then from there, they become, to me, there's a deeper poetic richness to them. Maybe it's just because having absorbed the facts, you know, I can kind of absorb more of the emotion as we go, but it definitely feels like, you know, like a swim, like diving deeper down into it. Can you say a little bit about the order in which they were written?
Yeah. It's completely in different order. So I think the first poem that I wrote from Night Swim was Cartouche. And then How to Make Pancakes for a Dead Boy. But the title poem in the book, Night Swim, which is also the first poem in the book, came probably three quarters of the way through the process. And the poems that I wrote last are some of the poems that are the most difficult to read, because when I was about three quarters of the way through the book, I thought it was done. And my editor said, there are poems missing from this book. And kind of pointed out, you know, not what poems to write, but kind of where there were gaps in the emotional process or in the narrative arc. And I knew what I needed to do to write those poems, which was to access literally a box in my attic that I didn't, that I hadn't opened, since their deaths. And it contained the police reports and the crime scene, you know, the crime scene photos, and my sister's journal was in there. And I didn't want to look at any of it or read any of it. And I hadn't been ready to, but, you know, I gave the manuscript a few weeks, I think, to kind of breathe. And then one day, I remember I was alone in my house, and it was a weekend, and I'm very, very rarely alone in my house. I have three kids, one, you know, and my boyfriend's son, my boyfriend, my mother, and a dog. So usually there's like six people running around, and I happened to be alone, and I just took a deep breath and I said, this is it. Today's the day. You know, I went up in the attic and I brought it downstairs, and I just remember I spread everything out in the, on my living room couch. I read all of it. I read all of it. And then those poems came. So I have some, you know, a couple of blackout poems, that blackout poems, and then poems that include lines from the police report, like directly from the police report. The poem Questions for My Mother, I think, came out of that process. Elegy for My Sister's Journal. Those were all the later poems that were the poems that I had emotionally resisted writing.
But I was curious if you had a a prompt or you had some stylistic goal in mind, or after reading that, how did you get that idea of how you wanted to address this material?
I actually, this is very ironic because I teach a lot of classes and workshops that incorporate prompts, and I'm pretty good at writing prompts. Mm-hmm. I don't do well with prompts myself. In fact, I participate in a weekly, well, I don't get to a weekly, but they meet weekly or twice a week. Some women get together and they write on prompts. And, you know, on the occasions that I can go, it's really difficult for me to write on a prompt. So,
yeah.
I mean, I know there are different styles of writing and different forms that I've used and structures, but I think that was just organic, like what felt like the right form or the right structure. Yeah. And then, you know, also I was and try always to be reading a lot. Mm. And so I might come across a form that I hadn't considered and thought that's just where this particular poem belongs, mm-hmm. is in that form. And that's happened to me also with, especially with difficult poems, form can be a really helpful way to write a poem that you're having trouble writing, mm-hmm. or that, like, you know, requires some kind of structure that you can't provide just in your own creative process. So,
yeah, I find that I used to depend a lot more heavily on prompts because I didn't know what. And, you know, I didn't know intuitively use a metaphor here. I just barely even was hanging on to what is a metaphor. And as I've gotten more practice with poetry, I find I rely on them a lot less. And in fact, like, if I've got something on my mind, you know, maybe the poem sort of presents itself how it wants to be presented. And if I walk into a workshop with that in mind, and then someone gives a prompt that's something else, it's like, I don't even try anymore. You know, if I'm really not feeling anything, I rely on a prompt, but usually I've got enough craft and enough substance going on that they're presenting themselves. But I think that comes from, you know, years of, as you say, reading. You're always reading. You're always kind of feeding your unconscious mind prompt and prompt material.
Yeah. And I find that usually those are the better poems. Those are my stronger poems, are the ones that come from, you know, like some place I can't quite identify.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it would be a little silly to ask which of these were the easy poems, because it doesn't feel like any of them came easily. But I think maybe a better question is, generally speaking, what is your writing process like? And how do you usually access a poem beyond having them kind of present themselves to you?
I feel like that is the hardest question to answer. I read somewhere recently, and I always forget who says these things that like stick with me, so I apologize, but I read somewhere, oh, I remember what it was something along the lines of, I never know how to write a poem until I write it. And that's truly 90% of the time how it feels. It's very hard for me to articulate how to write a poem. I really don't know which is, I mean, maybe that's what makes art and poetry so mysterious in some ways, is that you can write a book and not be able to articulate what your process is for writing a poem. I mean, sometimes the poems that I've written come from an image, you know, sometimes they come from, I'm just recounting something that happened. So for example, that first poem that I wrote, First Sunrise, it really just felt more like a journal entry You know, I was just describing the process of that first morning, like going into work, it was still dark out. You know, most teachers start our work day 2 hours before the sun comes up in the winter, you know, or in the early spring. So there's kids all over the place. People are making photocopies, but everything is very surreal.
Yeah.
You know, nothing, everything is different, and yet everything is the same. And so all I was doing in that poem was just, I think that poem literally took me 10 minutes to write. And I don't believe it really went through any revisions because it was just me describing what that moment was like, you know, exactly what happened. And then the other poem, Elegy for My Sister's Journal, you know, like I said, was extremely difficult to write. And I did do a lot of revising, especially at the end of it, where I wanted to capture, you know, what three things did I really envision, you know, were most likely the last things that my sister saw. And having to really think about that. I mean, there were probably 50 other things in the room that I could have focused on, but what did I want to convey about that loss?
And remind us again what the three things are.
A vase of fake flowers on the nightstand. Her daughter's picture on her phone home screen. And the hotel window sealed from the inside.
I have to tell you that line, you know, I love to analyze poems and it hits me first always emotionally in the gut. And then my brain kind of kicks in and goes, why did I have that reaction? Why did my gut feel that way? And I just remember reading that line going, it's so symbolic. It might be literally true, but also it's, you know, Eliot or Ezra Pound, you know, calling it the objective correlative. It's like, you know, being metaphorically sealed from the inside as well. So it's such a devastating line. And, you know, very telling of the emotional truth as well as the literal truth of what's going on in that scene. I'm very curious. Do you keep track of your original drafts? I know Ted Kooser was one of the first poets that I ever heard speak. And I remember him talking about keeping a notebook for each poem. And like he would write a version. I know it's like he must have a large house to keep track, like keep a notebook for each poem or something. I could be getting this wrong, but this is how I remember it. Was something like he said he writes a draft, turns the page, works on it some more, writes the next draft, da 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 da, and then if he feels he over edited it or he lost something that he wants back, he can just go back a few pages to an earlier draft. And that's how I've always done my editing. I'm always a little bit worried that, oh, what if the first word was the best word? What if I delete this and later I realize it was a huge mistake? So I always keep track of my revisions, and I do it all in like Word documents. So it's not taking up a lot of space in my literal living space, but I can always go back and, you know, draft one, draft two, draft what have you. So I'm curious if you've kept track of the things that you took out and the things that you left in.
I have not. Although, so the way that I write is I do all of my writing in Google Docs. So as I'm writing, if I'm not sure that I want something to look a certain way, I'll save the line underneath the poem itself. So I'll have like the current poem and then on the next page, I'll copy a line so I can save it and go back to it if I need to. But if I forget to do that in a Google Doc, you can also just edit, undo as many times as you want. And I think there's a way also to see drafts at different times. I'm not sure what that is, but I have not saved different versions. Now, there are poems in Night Swim that appear differently in the book than they did when they were published in a literary journal. So I have, you know, I have a record of that, but I don't generally keep a record. I'm not very good at record keeping in general. You know, I'm not a very organized person. I'm kind of a typical Libra in that way. I get confused about time. I have to put everything like in my online calendar and know that it's in one place. Otherwise, I really have no idea what's going on.
Well, that was that brings me to another very important question, which is, what is your astrological sign? And now I know you're a Libra. I didn't know that being disorganized was one of their qualities. I feel like I know some Libra who might take issue with that, but
my sun sign is I'm a Libra sun, but my moon and rising signs are both Sagittarius.
Oh no.
So I'm much more Sag than I am Libra.
My husband is a Sagittarius. So I'm very familiar with them. But I do want to bring it back. So I think the logical question is poetry sort of a way for you to get in touch with that, to kind of speak to yourself about how you're feeling?
It can be. It sometimes helps me sort through it. Mm-hmm. And the organization of Night Swim was a way of doing that too, into the stages of grief. Mm-hmm. I think that when, you know, the first probably 3 years after my nephew and my sister's deaths, all I could consciously feel was rage. Mm. I was consumed with rage at first of all, at my sister for leaving, what I perceived as her leaving.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I'm putting this in quotes because I don't feel this way anymore, but I did. And that was my process, feeling like she had left me, like alone with our mother who was aging and also grieving.
Yeah,
that she had left her, you know, her surviving child who was very young at the time. I was angry around the circumstances of my nephew's death and some of the things that did and did not take place that I believed should have taken place. Mm-hmm. I was angry. I mean, I could go on and on. I was angry at agencies for not identifying certain things. I was angry at the police. I was just angry, you know? And then after that, identifying other feelings became more difficult. Like I had to, okay, now I'm not angry anymore. So what am I? You know, what is this feeling that I'm having? And having to figure that out, especially I was diagnosed with PTSD after all of this happened. And so trying to delineate, you know, what is dissociative and what is contemplation, you know, what is sadness versus anger, what just trying to figure out. It's very hard when you're dealing with dissociation following trauma.
Yeah.
To determine really what's going on emotionally. And I'm not a very emotional person to begin with. So I think it was even maybe a little bit more difficult for me.
Yeah, there's a poem that you have. It's asking for help, I think. And in this poem, you give the list of the things that you advise your sister to do when you know that your nephew is having difficulty. And then at the end, you know, you ask about it and she says she didn't do any of it. And I know the poem is very straightforward, and no comment or very little commentary from the speaker of the poem. But I'll tell you, at the end of that poem, like, I was shocked and enraged too, you know, because obviously we know what the consequences are. She clearly doesn't at that point know what the consequences are, but we as the readers do. And it's, you know, there's anger and there's so many other feelings in there as well. You know, therapists will often say, like, underneath anger is like layers of other feelings that the anger is just hiding or protecting us from.
Yeah. And the context for all of that that is missing, you know, is a part of the conversation that I had with her afterwards when I asked her why didn't you do these things? And she said, I don't want him to be stigmatized.
Mm. Yeah.
And looking back on it, I that may have been true, but I also think she didn't want to be stigmatized. And a lot of times when you're a mother, and she was a single mother, you know, raising a child, and if your child is struggling and you feel like, you know, you haven't been a good mother in some way, even if that's not true,
mm-hmm.
Worried about how other people will perceive him, worried about how people will perceive you, and being kind of consumed with, you know, consumed with the possibility of shame or guilt or something like that. I don't really know. It's hard. It was hard for me to understand as a very concrete person. And also as a teacher, you know, it's like, okay, there's a struggling child. Here's what we do. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, I literally made it a list poem. Mm-hmm. And I did that on purpose, but it wasn't that simple for her. Mm-hmm. So that's the context that is missing in that poem, that I was too wrapped up in anger to write that poem.
Yeah.
Sense.
I wanted to ask, and I'm sorry if the book makes it clear and I missed it, but was she your older sister or younger?
She was 3 years younger than me.
That definitely would have been my guess. There's a lot of poems where you're talking about her as a child, and I definitely had that. You know, there are subtle cues about it, but I just wanted to make sure I was reading that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it sounds like there was some of the process of writing the poems and time and everything allowed you to get past some of the anger into some of those other feelings. And, you know, I notice as the poems go on, I think there's, like I said, the first part of it is kind of introducing us to the situation and what's happened. And then after that, there's more poems that I think demonstrate a little more of the tenderness, some of the flashbacks, some of the memories of how much you loved your sister and how you, you know, what it was like growing up with her. And so reading it, it sort of takes me as a reader through that experience of going through some of the shock of it and then getting into some of the, you know, deeper emotions around it.
Mm.
And I think with a book like this, I also want to know, it's only been out for a short amount of time, but have you been getting feedback from other people who have read the book who have or haven't experienced this kind of loss?
I have actually. The first probably 6 months or so after it came out, I had a lot of messages from people, a lot of emails, and it was actually really hard.
Mm.
and I have been a person who's written those kinds of emails and messages to poets who, you know, their work resonated very deeply with me or shifted something in me, and never thinking, oh my gosh, this might be difficult for someone to know how to respond to or, you know, to know what to say. But I received a lot of messages like that. And what's come out of all of that is this realization that there's this community of people, you know, all over the world, all over the country, who they haven't necessarily tried to take their own lives. They've survived the loss of other people to suicide and don't really talk about it. There isn't this you know, very vocal community of survivors of suicide loss. It's like a very quiet, kind of invisible tribe of people. Mm-hmm. But what I've found is that in doing readings, or like I went to AWP last year and meeting people, literally every single person that I have met or talked to has either lost someone to suicide or knows or is close to someone who's attempted.
Yeah.
Or they've attempted.
Yeah.
I mean, literally everybody. It's really, I don't know what the word is.
It's very prevalent. It's ubiquitous. It's the thing we're all not saying together.
Right.
And yeah, I find that kind of, I don't know, a little bit ironic about writers. I've been very blessed to be a writer and have a very strong writing community from an early age. You know, I knew I wanted to be a poet and a writer since I was in my early 20s. And so for me, hearing people talk about taboo subjects or very intimate personal subjects, like that's been, I've hardly ever known a day when that wasn't the case, where I couldn't like call up 10 people and be all like, hey, do you want to tell me the story of the worst thing that ever happened to you? I've got a great metaphor you can use. You know, like yeah. I've been very fortunate to have that community. So I'm always surprised to find out that's not everyone's experience. And I think that's part of why writing is still so important. Communicating through our writing is still so important because there are people out there who don't know that they're not alone in this situation.
Well, it's provided opportunities for me to connect with people mm-hmm. and to have those conversations. And we actually, at AWP this year in March, I have I'm moderating a panel called Invisible Kith, Poets on Loss to Suicide. So it's all poets that have significant bodies of work mm-hmm. That are focused on loss to suicide. And it's, you know, that's one of the things that has been most helpful to me mm-hmm. in the past year, is finding those people, kind of like finding this community that I really had no idea even existed.
Yeah, I noticed on the back jacket for Night Swim that one of the blurbs comes from Dianelli Antigua, mm-hmm. who we interviewed on the podcast. I think it was a year and a half. It was a while ago. I'm really losing track of time here. But she's very vocal. Her book, Ugly Music, want to give it a shout out. Wonderful, very gripping book. And she writes openly about her attempted suicides. And if you're following her on social media, she'll post on Suicide Awareness Day. And she'll post about, this is the anniversary of the day that I attempted it. And I think she's done a great job of bringing awareness and maybe destigmatizing and allowing people to know that it's okay to talk about their experiences and get help. And so I think that, I guess that didn't really surprise me to see her blurbing your book, because I know there's that crossover there.
Yes, that is the reason why I asked her to write it.
Yeah. When the book came out, how do I want to put this? Did you go seeking out people who you knew could talk on that subject, or did you already kind of have a community of writers who you knew you were in conversation with around that subject?
I did not have a community of writers that were in conversation around the subject. However, I've just been, you know, I've always read a lot. And so I had an idea of who I might want to ask. And, I've talked about Eugenia Lee a lot. She's, mm-hmm. I consider her to be a mentor. She's become a really dear friend. But her book, Blood, Sparrows, and Sparrows, which came out, I think it was a while ago, maybe like 7 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. She's the first Korean American writer mm-hmm. that I read who addressed issues of mental health and suicidal ideation, and trauma, you know, mm-hmm. talking about violence and her father and complex post-traumatic stress disorder and all of those things. And after, you know, I was reading her book after the year after I lost my nephew and my sister. And as I was reading it, I remember thinking, if she can write this book, maybe I have a book about this.
Yeah.
So she was the very first person that I wanted, you know, to ask, because she's just, her work really helped me believe that I had the courage to write this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, one of the wonderful things. It's a little hard to say words like wonderful, you know, useful, supportive, necessary things that poets get to do is when you are in difficult times to at least like inspire someone else and let them know, you know, you can get through this, you can make something of this. We had the poet Lois Jones, Lois P. Jones, who wrote Night Ladder on the podcast. And she says, you know, it's an alchemy, turning your experience and your grief and everything else into art. It is transforming something, it's making something. And I've always just wondered at that. I'm just always so astonished how, you know, I think a lot of people want to avoid the sad things, and if you don't avoid them, if you write about them specifically, you're going to feel better. And how it's kind of counterintuitive, we don't teach that, I think. We don't teach it effectively, but it's difficult, but then it feels better in the long run. It's the same thing with therapy. You know, the first year of therapy, your therapist is going to make you face things that otherwise you were avoiding. So I think the first year of therapy for most people can be a little difficult, but then it's like it gets better, hopefully, if it's a good therapy session, a good therapist, good relationship, hopefully it gets better over time.
Mm.
Yeah. That's my TED talk. Sorry, that wasn't.
No, it's fine.
It wasn't exactly a question in there, just like a PSA announcement. And while we're at it, this is going to lead to my next question. But I'm always recommending to folks who are writing about difficult subjects, there's a wonderful book called Writing as a Way of Healing, by Diane DeSilva. I'm pretty sure I got that right. Okay. And she talks about the ways that, you know, you can do it more effectively. So it's not just you dwelling on something bad that happened, but something that, you know, something that's going to really help make it transformative and leave you feeling lighter rather than heavier. So I want to shout out that book and recommend to everyone you get a copy and live by it. But I wanted to ask you, as you were writing this book, was there anything you were doing to, you know, self-care to make it easier for you to get through the writing process?
I probably should have. No, I don't think so. Well, okay. I'm in recovery. I participate in a 12-step fellowship, and from day one, after I these losses, I sought out, you know, my people in recovery, my sponsor, my close, you know, female friends in recovery. And that's just, I didn't even think of that because it's just so organic in everything that I do. So I did have that. That was very significant. And, you know, honestly, I put on a lot of weight. I really indulged in overeating as a way of numbing myself. That's something I've struggled with since I was probably 8 or 9 years old, you know, on and off. I am recovering from multiple eating disorders as well. Mm-hmm. So, but probably the, you know, the self-care piece would be staying connected to people that I trust and who I knew were not going to be angry with me for being angry. That's something that I couldn't be around family. I couldn't do that. You know, it became very difficult. People who were close to my sister, with a couple of exceptions, it became very difficult for me to be around them or to have, you know, there's this tendency when people die to consider them to be saints because they've died. And it drives me absolutely insane because it's not the truth. It's like something that human beings do to make themselves feel better or to honor those people. Yeah. Right. But the way that I look at it is you can't honor someone with a lie.
Yeah.
So there's that concrete part of me. I've never been able to, you know, I've never been able to align that tendency we have as human beings to, you know, somehow offer sainthood to people just because they died. I, you know, regardless of what happened, or my sister was a fierce, difficult, complicated woman who I loved very much, but the fact that she died did not make her a saint or an angel.
Right.
It just didn't. And when I die, I won't have been perfect. That people will, I want people to remember me for the good things and the bad things. And I want them to talk about it, you know? So I'm not sure where I was going with that.
No, but I find that very interesting. And forgive me, you know, I don't know if it's millennial brain or Gen X brain, but as soon as there's a question I don't know the answer, I start Googling. And so I was just thinking, yeah, we do say don't speak ill of the dead. That's like a phrase that is ubiquitous. And apparently it goes back to the ancient Spartans. I thought maybe it was something that came out of Christianity, but apparently it comes from the 3rd century biographer Diogenes Laertius, attributing the phrase to Chilon of Sparta. I've probably mispronounced all of that.
Okay.
But I mean, you don't have to listen to them. They had a different culture. We're more advanced, I hope, I think. And you're right. They're not. How do you honor someone if you don't talk about them fully and honestly? I think that's.
Well, and how do we honor ourselves without, without talking about the truth? You know, how do we create? How many poems can you write about, you know, what a wonderful person someone was?
Right.
It's just, you have to be able to write about all of it, you know?
Yeah.
The full experience of a human being and being a human being. And a lot of that is ugly. It just is.
No, very true. And I have a very dark sense of humor. So like, it's so true. And how could you possibly not know that or not accept that or not expect that or not talk about it? I think in your collection, there are so many just wonderful individual lines, but what you just said reminded me of this poem that you have. I'm forgetting the name, but it's the one about, I think it's called something like Instead of the Zoo, about taking your niece to the zoo and how if you do that, inevitably she will be disappointed by the fact that the animals she wants to see aren't showing up and that the train won't, whatever, all the things that are inevitably disappointing. So it's just like, let's just do this fantasy thing instead, you know, and then it becomes this very interesting, you know, I don't know if I would quite call it surreal, but it's fantastical about like what would be a better alternative to going to the zoo. I'm a little curious in your writing of these poems, was there any point where you thought, you know, I need to engender some more levity or some more hope Was that kind of an intentional choice, or did some of those poems, like the one about the zoo, kind of emerge or unexpectedly? Could you say a little bit about that?
So, yeah, I don't know. I never really thought about that, to be honest, because when I wrote this book, I truly didn't believe it would ever be published. I couldn't imagine a press that would want to publish an entire book of these poems. They were so difficult and so tragic and very true in all of that. I mean, there's, when you're going through the acute phases of grief, you know, especially like loss to suicide or something that's very unexpected and preventable, you're not focused on hope, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had moments of light, and especially remembering, you know, remembering them the way that they were, but there just wasn't a lot of that. And there still isn't. I mean, it will always be tragic for our family. And the thing is, though, I love reading other people's poems that are very hopeful and light. Like, I am obsessed with Chen Chen because he is able to strike this balance, or not even a balance. It's like he strikes this, just this chord of absurdity, like how absurd the world can be and how painful it is, but also, oh, look at that bird hanging upside down. And like, he just is able to, he's really, I feel like, one of the most brilliant poets of our generation. Because he's able to do that in a way that I read it and read it and read it, and I've still never written a poem like that. You know?
Well, I always think that there's these poems that there's the poets who write like us and they're guiding us or speaking in a voice that we recognize. And then there's the poets where you're just like baffled, pleasantly baffled by them, going, I so appreciate that. I have no idea how you do it. You know? And he might be one of those.
He is for me.
Yeah. Well, and then that does lead me to another question. It sounds like you've been reading a lot, and as an ongoing practice, are there any particular books that you were focusing on with this one? I know you already mentioned, let me get it right, Sparrows of Blood.
Blood, Sparrows, and Sparrows.
Yes, you already mentioned Blood, Sparrows, and Sparrows. Mm-hmm. Were there other books that you were turning towards for inspiration stylistically or in terms of the content?
I read Don't Call Us Dead by Dinesh Smith right around this time. I think it was the same year or the year after, you know, Frankie and Julia died, that Don't Call Us Dead came out. And that book completely floored me, completely. And still, when I go back to it, completely floors me. I did read Ugly Music, the one that you mentioned. And that was, you know, during the process of writing. I read a lot of James Diaz, who was the editor-in-chief of Anti-Heroin Chic. And has written a few books. And I remember reading a lot of his writing, which is very honest and very raw and very vulnerable. And of course, I'm probably going to remember, you know, 50 other books as soon as this is over. Ellen Bass, The Human Line. I was reading The Human Line. And since the book has come out, there have been so many people. M.T. Velarda I read for the Laureate Prize at Harbor Review last year, and their entire book is about the loss of their partner to suicide. And that was the winner of that prize. This year, Kay Ivor has a book that just came out, you know, with a focus also on the same thing. There's just so many, but I'm not sure at the time.
I was very surprised to hear you say that you didn't know if anyone would publish this. And it's something that writers and my writing group at the Poetry Salon say not too infrequently, like, can I really get this book published? It seems to be on a very heavy subject. Is anyone really going to want to read this? And I've read so many books that I feel like they're on a heavy subject. Mary Jo Bang's book Elegy, I mean, the title says it, and it's all poems about her son's death. And you know, I maybe going back to what Lois P. Jones says about it being an alchemy, but I know for me, I was reading a novel that I was obligated to read. It was fine, not really moving me, but you know, fine. And then I stopped reading that novel to read Night Swim to prepare for our interview. And I remember just, you know, it being this balm to me going, just, we're talking real talk here. You know, the novel I happened to be reading was a bit escapist literature, let's call it that. And I found myself really bristling, going like, oh, come on, people don't, that's, what is this? Your perfect man? Like, no man's like that. And just stop it. Stop lying to me, book. And then reading your book and feeling like, here's a person telling me the truth. I'm grateful there's a person treating me like a person, talking to me about the real things, doing it in a way that's, you know, artistically interesting, but also just a real person talking about real things. And there's something about that. Yeah,
I think that that's well, I think what was going on is that my own process was so unpalatable to me that I really had no confidence that it would be palatable to anyone else. I mean, yeah, you know, when the book was published, my mother wanted to read it, and I took a copy and I ripped out all the poems that I didn't want her to read because I didn't write them to hurt her. And I also was in a different place now, yeah, you know, and she and I had come to a different place than I had been when I wrote those poems. So this feeling of like, my grief is not palatable enough, was very real. And it still is. I mean, I've had some really negative experiences
yeah,
with people reading the book and really being terrible to me because of one or two poems that they just feel like from their perspective were not the truth. And that's the thing about truth, is that there are concrete facts that you can list. And then, you know, the truth as you interpret something is very subjective, and human beings are very complex. And so the way that someone appears or seems to one person can be very different to someone else.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about family versus, you know, someone who's only known them for a shorter period of time and whatever. And so I think that this whole idea that grief should be palatable to people in order to spare them the depths of despair, you know, is very, really infuriating, actually. Yeah. But to acknowledge that to acknowledge where it comes from, you know, I have a couple of friends who have become very ill, with long-term illnesses, and I find myself really struggling to maintain friendships with them because it scares me, you know? So I've been reflecting a little bit on that because I think that my the intensity of my grief process was frightening to people. And it brought up things in them that they weren't ready to deal with. And then they became angry at me for bringing any of it up, you know? So looking back on it, I have a better understanding of what was going on. I will forever be grateful to Patty Payne at Diode Editions for reading this and not caring that it wasn't palatable, you know, and believing in it.
Yeah, I find that, again, I'm so lucky to be immersed from such a young age in such a heartfelt, you know, no BS kind of poetry community, because I felt like, you know, we're always, a lot of writers often are trying to get to the depth of something and not shy away from it. You know, it's like what Rumi says in his poem, The Guest House. It's like this being human is a guest house, and every day some emotion comes up and you've got to treat it honorably, and you don't know what, I'm doing it badly, you know, I'm paraphrasing it badly, but it's like, you don't know what grief is going to clear out for a joy, but you've got to treat each guest, each visitor honorably. And it's like, yeah, I mean, what you don't acknowledge, what you run from, it's going to turn on you. It's going to turn malignant. So often I feel like it's, you know, part of the job of the writer to look at it, you know, survive it, live through it, and then you know, allow other people to know that they're not alone in that experience. And I want to be very careful here, you know, I am not a licensed therapist, and anyone who is experiencing anyone who's experiencing life, we should all be in therapy. Just everyone should be. I think that it should be like, you know, you graduate high school and you immediately get assigned a therapist, or you know, you graduate kindergarten and immediately get assigned a therapist to help walk you through it, because life is very challenging. So I just want to put that out there. But I think that's one of the things that poetry can really do, is touch into those feelings, not shy away from them, give other people courage to know, like, hey, if this feeling is going to come up for you, you can get through it. I got through it. And I think that's something that your book does. It's awful to read it, but it's also really, really cathartic to read it as well. And I want to ask, did you eventually let your mother read the poems, all the poems?
No.
Okay.
No. She's 81, and it's just not necessary.
Right.
It's really not. She's also not, I don't know, part of it is cultural also. Mm-hmm. There's this cultural piece of it, because my mother is Korean, and it's interesting because Korea and the United States have two of the highest suicide rates in the world. And then like some impoverished, you know, Slavic countries as well. But Korean culture is very much about not saying things, you know, about, it's very, there's this deeply rooted Confucian way of approaching life that in many ways helped Korean people throughout history to survive colonization and war, that you find a way to survive. You keep your mouth shut if you want to stay alive for the next generation, and you figure out what part you're here to play.
Yeah.
And you play it to the best of your ability, and that's it.
Yeah.
So this book does none of that. It does none of that. And it also, my mother is very religious, very Christian, evangelical Christian. That's how I grew up. And it's not a very Christian book either. It's I feel like the concept of forgiveness is also very annoying. Like I'm very bothered by this expectation that we all forgive each other, and that, you know, in the Christian faith, you know, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, there's a way of being redeemed. And all it is to ask for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all you have to do. And if you're Catholic, say some Hail Marys, I guess. And that's like, if you think about it, it's like so odd. And I just feel like there should be some action that is required to, you know, in recovery, you make amends. You know, there's like a very formal process for making amends, and you determine what action is spiritual and makes sense to make amends for the specific thing, the specific harm that you caused.
Yeah.
You know, it's a process. You write about it, you talk about it with your sponsor, and then you do those things. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, once again, so the book is not Confucian, the book is not Christian, and the book does not promote this concept of forgiveness just for forgiveness's sake. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think that she'll ever read it. That's okay.
That might very well be for the best. And I know I've heard that, how do I want to call it, the, you know, the backlash or the, anyways, questioning what forgiveness is, what it's for, if it's necessary, how helpful is it, and everything. So I certainly know that's a topic that is really, has some very interesting discussion going on around it. At this point. So I think some people will be very excited to know that the book intentionally isn't going to ask them for that. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, that makes it a more honest book, I'm sure, for you. We could talk for a long time about this. I want to ask all these exact same questions again of your next book, but of course, you know, time is limited, tempus fugit, as they say. So I think my last question that I've been wondering about since I started reading the book is the first poem in the book, mm-hmm. and also the title poem, Night Swim. The whole book is very rooted in your experience in autobiography. But the first book centers around this unnamed guy who goes swimming at night up and down the coast of North and South Korea. And I'm just very curious, like, how that poem arose and how you knew it belonged here and how you knew it was the title poem.
So I read an article online about a man who escaped North Korea, actually was able to swim through some sort of pipe. I don't remember like exactly what it was, but he was wearing, you know, wet gear, a wetsuit, and made it, you know, to the other coast and ended up in South Korea. And exactly the way that I wrote the poem is what happened. This is straight from the article. He was like in a near hypothermic state, just wandering around. And he went on for some time before he was found. And there's video footage of him doing this. And when I read the article, and it's very blurry footage, you know, it's from like some sort of security camera. But I tried just to imagine what that must have been like, you know, to have been swimming in almost complete darkness, in this state of danger, you know, physical danger, political danger.
Yeah.
And then to make it to the other side in a place that, you know, you're now in another country, but it was, you know, until very recently in history, it was one country.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it just kind of hit me as I was reading the article that that's exactly what grief felt like for me. You know, that that first night that after my nephew died, I woke up and everything felt different. My body felt different. I had all these auditory hallucinations. So I was like hearing things, and I still have like some auditory processing problems overnight, you know? And yet here I was in the same world, in the same life. Everyone was doing the same things, you know, I because I was in a state of shock. I think I went to work.
Yeah.
And so to just be kind of wandering around in this world where, you know, supposedly it's the same world, but nothing is the same. Nothing can ever be the same.
Yeah.
And even now, you know, more than 5 years later, nothing is the same. I won't ever be the same person. And so in terms of like knowing that it was the title poem, I don't know how I knew that. I just knew. Mm-hmm. And generally a title poem doesn't come at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And I argued back and forth with my editor about this, and I insisted that it be the first poem, because I just couldn't see any other poem doing what I needed it to do at the start of that book. I mean, that became like a guiding poem and a guiding image for me as I was structuring the book.
Yeah. No, I love that poem. I love that it comes first. In fact, I working with another friend of mine who's working on her manuscript, and I was telling her, read Joan Kwan Glass's book, Night Swim. Look at the poem she uses to open. I think you need a poem like that to open your collection. So
I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I really like about it is that it looks towards something besides us. And by us, I mean, like, you know, the person writing the poem. And hey, how do I connect this to something else, to a bigger story? And then, of course, it's also just, I mean, that is such an odd image and an odd experience. Did the man ever say why he was out swimming like that late at night?
Well, he was escaping.
Ah.
He was escaping from North to South Korea. And apparently the work that he did in North Korea made it so that he could withstand the temperature of the water. He worked, I forget exactly what it was, but he did something in the water.
Uh-huh.
So he had the equipment, you know, he had the ability to swim like that and to withstand those temperatures for the period of time that he did.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you've read two poems already. I would love it if you would read Night Swim before we close out.
Oh,
would
sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, this is Night Swim. In February, a man in flippers and wetsuit swims undetected across the East Sea, along the border of North and South Korea. Once on land, he crawls through a drain beneath barbed wire, walks for miles before being caught. Video footage shows him at 4 a.m. in Gosan Village, security tower strobe light flashing out, exposing him. He takes a few steps forward, then teeters back, hesitates, confused, afraid, and hypothermic. How many of us have swum through current of grief or shock, only to find ourselves disoriented, standing on the shore of a strange country. After loss to suicide, the landscape doesn't change, but everything else does. They don't release the man's name, don't show his face, only the back of his body as he staggers forward in the darkness, trying to convince himself, I am home. I am home.
You've been listening to Joan Kwan Glass reading from her first book, Night Swim, from Diode Editions. Joan, just again, thank you so much for being here, for sharing this work with me and with the other readers, and to everyone who's listening to the Poetry Salon Saloncast. I really hope you go out and get this book, and if you like it, she's already got her next one out. So, and that one's from Milk and Cake Press.
Yes, it's called If Rust Can Grow on the Moon.
If Rust Can Grow on the Moon. And you can also get the chapbook Making Pancakes for a Dead Boy from Harbor Editions.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!